Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. On this episode, I'm joined by Project Goemon to discuss the Ganbare Goemon series, better known as Mystical Ninja in the West. We explore the franchise's unexpected origins, dig into the dozens of Japan-only titles, and of course, finalize Goemon's Smash moveset. In the game section, I give some thoughts on the first part of Another Code Recollection, Another Code 2 Memories, which is a reimagining of the original Trace Memory on the DS. Plus, in the news, I analyze the latest Nintendo sales figures and throw out some last-minute predictions for the Nintendo Direct. Let's jump right into the feature on the Ganbare Goemon series with Project Goemon. This episode's feature is about another iconic Japanese gaming franchise that doesn't often find its ways overseas. I'm talking about Konami's Ganbare Goemon, perhaps best known as Mystical Ninja in English. The long-running series blends Japanese culture and comedy, plus it's no stranger to Nintendo hardware. Joining me to chat all about the series is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello everyone, my name is David, and I'm pretty much the person in charge of Project Goemon, a project I started in order to explore all the games in the Ganbare Goemon series.
Thanks for joining me. Let's touch a bit on the basics before we really dig in. What is the Ganbare Goemon franchise?
The Ganbare Goemon series is a video game series produced and developed by Konami from 1986 until 2005 or so, revolving around the folklore hero Ishikawa Goemon, or really like a caricature version of Goemon. And most of the games are side-scrolling platform games, but there's a lot of variety, and the series has 20 games in the main series, plus some other like spin-offs, etc., which makes it, I suppose, an interesting topic, especially for a long-term project like this one.
How did you personally get into the series?
That's a good question. The reason why I started this project was basically because I wanted to go back to those roots that time when I first encountered Goemon. I grew up in Latin America, and maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense, but the fact that in Latin America, video games were maybe not as mainstream as they were in other places around the world. And there was one time when I went to a video shop to rent out some tapes. At that time, I was playing on a Nintendo NES, and I had gotten an SNES maybe the year before. So this is about 92, 93. I saw this game with a really amazing cover, which later I would know was made by Tom DuBois. It showed like a painting of a boy riding a tiger. And in the background, all these really madcap enemies and things that were really, really stunning at the time. So I took the game out. I played it. I later found out the game was The Legend of the Mystical Ninja. And from that point onwards, I kept a check on the franchise. I kept a check on the series. But it was maybe not until the N64, the Nintendo 64, when they had the second big game in the series for people outside Japan, which was Mystical Ninja starring Goemon, that the series really took shape for me. That game had a big, big impact on me. And it was placed really ideally between Mario 64 and The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And it was like an excellent bridge between those two games because of the way it tried to translate a lot of the 2D elements into 3D. Looking back on it, I think Legend of the Mystical Ninja, the original SNES game, is also one of the reasons why I decided to move to Japan, because that's when I became interested in the hiragana, katakana, romaji, and kanji. And also all the more traditional aspects of Japanese culture.
There's a lot to touch on, but let's start with square one, with the first game, 1986's Mr. Goemon for the arcades. It's a side-scrolling action platformer starring Ishikawa Goemon, which you mentioned is a folk hero from Japanese history. First of all, why did Konami decide to make an arcade game starring this legendary figure?
That's one of the big mysteries behind this series. But what I uncovered in my research is that first, there was a popular series of the anime series, Lupin the Third. Okay. It's a long-running series, anime series, of course. But especially that season was especially significant because it featured Ishikawa Goman the 13th quite a lot, and there were some memorable plots. At the same time, I also uncovered that Ishikawa Goman, the folklore hero, became sort of like a historical figure, although mm-hmm. not a lot is known about him, actually. There's maybe like one secondhand notice about him in history. And all of the other ones are very, very vague notes about him. So Goemon is a popular hero from the Edo era. He became known as a hero that stood against the evils and tyrannies of the world and was justice for the common person. And if you think about that and you think about the heroes around the Famicom era, the arcade games of that era, like maybe it could be a common trope, something easy, that here's a hero and he's fighting against all these evil samurai, which are like all the popular tropes from that time. And also it makes, I suppose, making enemies and creating sprites easier because at least they have some shape in the designer's minds. So it came from that. And of course, they made something that was akin to the Ghosts and Goblins of that time, right?
Yeah.
Makaimura. Which was a game that really shook the video game world in Japan quite a lot because it was a side-scrolling game with a lot of invention. And you can, maybe you could tell that from then, Konami, they made Rushing Attack. And from Rushing Attack, they took a lot of those things and they said, how about we make another game similar to that? And that became like Mr. Goemon. Maybe. I think that's what happened, but we don't really know.
How similar is the first game to the rest of the franchise?
Mr. Goemon?
Yes.
Not a lot, actually. Although, there's one interview that was done about 15, 18 years ago with the creators of the first Ganbare Goemon, which was Karakuri Dochu. The producer, Kazuhisa Hashimoto, talks about they had an arcade game, Mr. Goemon. It was a side-scrolling action game, and they got the word from Konami that either it was make a game at the same time as Mr. Goemon or something a bit later adapted to the Famicom. It was not possible because Mr. Goemon is a really amazing game in terms of sprites and animation, etc. It's really impressive for the time. And when the producer Hashimoto tried to adapt it to the Famicom, he found out that it's really impossible. So he changed the focus. He said, okay, instead of moving just from left to right around towns in medieval Japan, in feudal era Japan, how about we let the player just move around the town completely? Just up, down, left, right. And how about we integrate things from other games? Some people would say that the first Ganbare Goemon game, it's like a mix of Mario plus Zelda, put them together with some other action elements. And that's what you get. You have a new setting with a lot of the familiar tropes. And the first game, Karakuri, then became the basis for the entire series.
What really stuck out to me when doing research for the podcast is that, Goemon used to look completely different. He was much closer to the ukiyo-e art style instead of his more famous cartoonish look. When did the franchise become what we know it as today?
The image that we know today was really cemented in Ganbare Goemon 2, Kiteretsu Shogun Maginus, which is the second game for the Super Famicom, which you could say is like the second generation of Goemon. You have the first generation of Goemon, which is the Famicom one, which has Ganbare Goemon, Karakuri Dochu, Ganbare Goemon 2, the RPG Gaiden. You have Legend of the Mystical Ninja, the first of Super Famicom game, and Gaiden 2 plus the Game Boy game, Sarawata Ebisumaru. You have that first generation, which has more traditional elements of feudal Japan, Edo-era Japan. And then from Ganbare Goemon 2, they took most of those elements, but left some of the more esoteric ones. They tried to make it wackier, more filled with comedy. They added a lot more friends and anime-style enemies. It's easier to understand, and at the same time, it really had its original characteristics, original what we call now Goemon-style game elements.
The series seems to shift genres quite often. Sometimes it's a side-scroller, sometimes it's a top-down Zelda-like. Do you have a preferred style of gameplay? Is there a structure you think of when you think of a quote-unquote real Goemon game?
It's difficult to say because I've played so many Goemon games now. I'm pretty much right now at the PlayStation era. And at the PlayStation era, you can see that they're trying to mix a lot of things and it's not successful in general, maybe I would say. But the thing is that I think it depends a lot on what the developers, they wanted to really convey to the player. And I think, for example, like I said, Gamberg Woman 2, Kiteretsu Shogun Magine, the second Super Famicom game, is really amazing in the vision it has. Apparently, it was made with really four people for 60% of the game, of the development time.
Oh, wow.
And it really shows that they have like a clear vision of this is what we want to show, right? It's not my favorite game, but it's really amazing in the way it goes. Because I think the my favorite aspect of the series is that it's like a video game tour of feudal Japan, of Edo era Japan. Like you go through the game from start to finish and you start from these areas. The game takes you to a certain place and the destination is not the point. The trip is always what it's really about. And I think that's what I like about it. My favorite game in the series, personally speaking, is Gamberg Woman 3, which is Zelda-like with Metroidvania elements. And the way it tells the story, how it plays, how you find out things, and the way it shows everything, that's really amazing. I was really impressed. Which also reminds me that maybe one of my other favorite games is the last game in the series, Tokaido 2, for the DS, which is completely different in as much as it's an overhead perspective, but seen like a three-quarters view, like oblique perspective. And it's actually, it's a game based on an ukiyo-e series by Utagawa Hiroshige. And what they did is that they contacted a company, what Konami contacted a company that made these backgrounds based on the ukiyo-e prints. And they put them as a backgrounds for Goemon and the other characters to just run around. And at that time, when I played that game, that really blew my mind because I thought, I can't believe that they did it. That they adapted ukiyo-e into a video game and they made it like this. And it's also very similar in as much as it's an exploration game, but it's very, very laid back. There's not a lot of risk to the player. You're just going through these vistas, right? Ukiyo-e vistas around like historical vistas. And that's what really appeals to me about Goemon, actually.
The first game localized was actually the fifth game in the franchise, known as The Legend of the Mystical Ninja. It then got two localized games on the N64 and then two Game Boy titles. Out of the localized games, which one stand out to you?
Of course, I think for everyone, Legend of the Mystical Ninja, the first SNES game, really stood out to a lot of people because of its humor, because of the content, because it's something that you didn't see at all outside Japan, really. In Japan, even then, they didn't have so many games based around like Edo era or that kind of thing in Japan. But in the West especially, it was like a big shock. And you see it in all the magazines and the reviews that at the time, I mean, you have the 90s style of humor where they say, oh, it's so wacky, like the wacky Japanese, etc.
Right.
But I mean, the game does play to that, but actually it's the way it creates the atmosphere, the humor is really outstanding. Actually, it's a really frustrating game later after maybe about the level 5 or so because of the way it's structured, but especially because also I forgot to say that one of the elements that makes it memorable is that very early on, starting with Goemon 2 on the Famicom, it introduced simultaneous two-player gameplay, so you can play it with a friend or my brother. And we played again a lot through that game, actually, through Legend of Mystical Ninja. It's one of my most treasured memories. Which is interesting because later, when it came to the N64, the Goemon team, the development team, they tried to put simultaneous two-player action in the game, but they failed because of the various things that they had to think about to make it into 3D. And Mystical Ninja starring Goemon on the N64 is particularly impressive game in as much as it's a 3D platformer not made by Nintendo, which tries to tackle a lot of the problems of 3D or early 3D, but it tackles them in a very different way. It has an amazing sense of immersion. When you see it now, it maybe looks a bit primitive, but the way it creates the environments, the way it creates the atmosphere, all the different elements, the story elements, it's really amazing what they did with so little, really. And of course, the key point for a lot of people who play the Goemon games is maybe they like the gameplay, they like the storylines, etc. But for a lot of people, it's the music. The music, which probably there's no game in the franchise which has a bad soundtrack. They're all at least very good. And like Legend of the Mystical Ninja is probably my favorite soundtrack on the SNES. Mystical Ninja starring Goemon probably has the best soundtrack on the N64. in my opinion, of course, but it's really amazing. The thing is that people don't realize, for example, is that yes, SNES had a dedicated sound chip, and so they could create these amazing soundtracks with that sound chip, but the N64 didn't. And so a lot of games of that era, they stripped back or they gave less resources to the music. But for the Goemon games, the Goemon team purposefully, they tried to give as much space to the composer as possible. And that's why you get these amazing soundtracks, both for Mystical Ninja starring Goemon, the first game, and the second game, Goemon's Great Adventure or Mystical Ninja starring Goemon 2, as they call it in the Europe. Two key songs in the game, Mystical Ninja starring Goemon and I Am Impact, are incredibly memorable.
You mentioned it, but the franchise is really rooted in Japanese culture and has many references and jokes geared towards the Japanese audience. I've seen the Ganbare Goemon games labeled as quote-unquote too Japanese. Do you think there are elements in the game that are maybe off-putting to Western audiences? Or do you think that the franchise is appealing because it is so steeped into Japanese comedy and culture?
I might say it's like a double-edged sword. It was a double-edged katana in some way, you could say.
Yes.
In as much as, yeah, that's what its appeal. And also that's why, for example, Konami apparently was very hesitant about bringing it to the West. Konami, I think, had a strange relationship with the West. Like, they were very hesitant to release a lot of their games to the West, which were not aimed to a Western audience. And Goemon was like the exception that, like, it kind of proved the rule, because apparently Legend of Mystical Ninja and the N64 games did not sell that well. But at the same time, they have a huge cachet with the people who did like it. And I would say that I think it just goes both ways, actually. You can't separate the two. Goemon comes from a Japanese perspective, Japanese culture. And at the same time, yep, it's off-putting if you're not into it. But if you do like it, I think you will like the Goemon games for sure.
For those who have played the Western Goemon games and enjoyed them, what are some Japanese-only titles that you would recommend to them?
Definitely the Quadrology, or I don't know how to say it, but yeah, the four games in the Super Famicom series. Mm. If you take out Legend of Mystical Ninja, you have Gamera Goemon 2, 3, and Kira Kira Dochu, the one set in outer space. They are the one that I would really recommend. And going back, I would say that I tried to play, now they're all translated, all the Famicom games too, especially Gamera Goemon 2, which has also really a fantastic soundtrack. Gaiden 2, the second RPG, is really, really good. And one that a lot of people, I think, overlook, because maybe it's a bit too simple, but the first Game Boy game, which had an official translation of sorts, which was included in a Game Boy Color compilation, which was released, I think, in around 1999 or 2000, only in Europe and PAL regions, also called, very confusingly, Mystical Ninja starring Goemon, but it's the first Game Boy game. Mm. That has probably one of the most sophisticated storylines in the whole franchise, because you have to keep track of who's kidnapping who, what is happening, who's betraying who. There are a lot of factions, and that's really, it's a very simple game, but the storyline really makes it worth it.
The last new Goemon game was 2005's Ganbare Goemon Tokaidochu Oedo Tinguri Kayashi no Maki for the Nintendo DS. It's been nearly two decades since we've seen Goemon. Why do you think the series suddenly came to a halt, despite having more than 20 games in the franchise up to that point?
Well, the short answer is basically that the people in charge, they left Konami.
Hmm.
But if I go back in time and go through the series, one thing that stood out to me analyzing the series is that I think Konami did not really expect Goemon to last for so long. That year when it was released in Japan, you get the feeling from all the documents that it was like Konami said, okay, this is where it stops. Like, we have the SNES game, we have the Game Boy game, we have the last RPG, and let's just end it here. And then people within the company, they were so excited about Goemon, they did a lot of things, and they restarted the franchise again with Ganbare Goemon 2 for the Super Famicom. And that started a new era. And then there was many fits and starts. And unfortunately, some of the games were not so good. And the last game, the DS game, was like a farewell to Goemon. Because after everything that happened, they were leaving the company. And they said, okay, for the last game we make, let's try to make something really special. And then this Goemon team, they went and they make their own company, especially the main producer, Itsunobu Ebisu. He made a company called Goodfeel, which has made a lot of games, and it has been in charge of a lot of development of a lot of Nintendo games too, I think. But Konami themselves, apart from two Pachislo, like pachinko and slot games, they have not done anything with the franchise. Mainly, I think, because they don't want to revive it, really. It has not been a series that's been so popular outside of Japan. And also, I think there's some bitterness. There's some difficult things there, I think.
Do you think Konami might one day put out a new Goemon game, or at least a collection of past titles?
A new game, I think the chances are very low, to be honest. Mm. Because one thing that must be said is that because there's a lot of humor, there's a lot of comedy in the Gambare Goemon series, and that humor is kind of rooted really in late 80s, 90s Japanese culture. If they do make a new Goemon game, it's going to feel very different. Mm. And a lot of the people who were involved in the Goemon games, they're not involved at all. So it'll be a new team making a Goemon game with a very different appeal and a very different approach. And it'll maybe turn out like the Police Engine games, which were made by new teams, which did not really know what to do with Goemon. And it kind of shows in the games. But I am at least hopeful that they will put out a collection of the games, at the very least, the Famicom games, the Super Famicom games, so that younger generations can maybe play and understand this aspect of Japanese gaming that was really appealing to a lot of people, actually.
You mentioned Goodfill. Last year, they put out Mamede no Bakeru, which many have described as very Goemon-inspired. Have you given this game a try? And if so, what did you think about it?
Maybe as you can tell that I'm not so young. And I have a family of my own. I have a son. He reads Korokoro Comics, a popular comics magazine here in Japan that is aimed at elementary school-age children.
Right.
And he was reading about Mamede no Bakeru, about everything that was happening. But when he got his Nintendo Switch last year as his Christmas present, he chose that game out of his own volition with nothing of me. I didn't say anything. He chose that game and said, yep, let's get it. And I've been watching him play it. I've been helping him a little, but I haven't watched him play it. And I think it's a little unfair that they describe it like a Goemon successor of sorts, because it's not really, I mean, yes, it has a lot of these elements from Goemon, like the traveling elements, like going on all around Japan. But it's its own thing, it's its own series, and the humor is very, very different. It's really aimed at elementary school-age children who are interested in Japan and traveling around Japan. And unfortunately, I think that it's a little unfair because also I think a lot of people were expecting a new Goemon game from that. And when it didn't turn out that way, a lot of people, I don't know, kind of ignored it. Mm. And unfortunately, it's kind of reflecting the sales of the game. It hasn't been doing so well. Maybe because, I don't know, maybe some the people who were looking forward to it, they were turned off by the aesthetic and the game itself. And the people who it might have been geared for, maybe they did not see the appeal so much.
Let's talk about your work, Project Goemon. How did this project start, and what are some of your ongoing goals?
It's the Project Goemon. It started, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, when I came to a certain age, and I thought, what are some games that I've missed that I should be playing? Because I'm not so interested in so much in what people are playing right now. And when I thought about it, I came upon the Gambare Goemon series, and I thought, okay, I'll make it like a project of mine to just play through all the games in the series. And the more games I played, especially with Karakuri Dochu, what I discovered is that there's more to Goemon than just the Goemon games. That all the history of Konami, a lot of the history of that, especially the early Famicom era, the Super Famicom era, and the transition to 3D, the Nintendo 64, PlayStation, is intertwined with Goemon in a really sophisticated and really interesting way. And I thought, okay, so I'll go through the games, I'll play through them, I'll write reviews, but also I'll write about everything that was happening around them. That has been a really worthwhile, really interesting trip. Unfortunately, right now it's slightly on hiatus because of personal things, but I finished up to all the Super Famicom games. And I'm right now into the PlayStation era. I'm going chronologically through all the games. And my goal is at least to create a good sense of what was happening, especially with those games that we don't know much about. The PlayStation games right now, I'm really focusing on and trying to find as much info as possible because we kind of know who made them. But why did they make them this way? What was happening? I think that's maybe one key point that I really want to leave, at least for the next generations to discover, because there's a lot of information about Goemon on the internet, but not a lot of good information, to be honest. Hmm. And if I can make something that's useful for people to think about and to analyze about the Japanese development scene in the mid-1990s, I think that would be really useful for everyone, especially video game historians.
Oh, yeah. When I was doing research for this podcast episode right now, I was looking at Project Goemon for all my information. Most of the useful information was on Project Goemon. So I really highly recommend listeners check it out if you want to learn more about Goemon. So it's time to wrap up, and I need to bring out my ultimate question. If Goemon became a playable character in Smash Brothers, what should his moveset be?
Maybe I should say that he has become like an official playable character of sorts. First, in the official Smash Brothers, he's like a costume, right?
Yes, yes.
But a also, if people don't know, there's a project called Smash Remix, an official project which patches the original Smash Brothers and puts a lot of characters and new stages, etc., which is really impressive. You can play as Goemon and Ebisumaru in that game. It's really recommended. The basic points are, of course, Goemon has his Kiseru pipe. Basically, he's just beating people with his Kiseru pipe. And maybe he has his supers from Legend of the Mystical Ninja. You train for them at the dojo. And you train for those supers and maybe riding the dragon or Goemon Impact. Suddenly, for his super move, he takes out his conch shell and he calls Impact, and then Impact completely destroys the stage. Would be an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, I didn't mention it, but Goemon's iconic weapon is a pipe called the Kiseru, which I've never seen any other video game character or any other character in fiction fight with a pipe. Does he ever smoke out of the pipe?
In the first arcade game, yes, he does. And he kind of does in the Famicom games, but you kind of have to look very carefully because it's all very like one pixel.
Okay. Yeah. Kids, don't smoke if you're listening to this podcast. And hopefully that was a very thorough look at the exciting Gambare Goemon franchise. So Project Goemon, where can people find you?
The best way to find me is really through my website, projectgoemon.wordpress.com, which I need to update more, but at least it has all of my writing. And I've been writing more. I just have to put it on the internet. Aside from that, I do have a Twitter account, which I'm there a little hesitantly, but there's a lot of good information, a lot of good discussion there. And I'm in a lot of other social platforms as Project Goemon. Just search for my name. You'll find me, no problem.
Great. And the links to everything will be in the podcast description. So listeners, check it out. Project Goemon, once again, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much. It was great fun.
Okay, games time. Last episode, I talked about Another Code Recollection, the reimagining of the original DS and Wii games from the late 2000s. Well, I cleared the first game, Another Code 2 Memories, aka Trace Memory, in the States, so let's talk about it. This is kind of a strange one because unlike most game collections, Another Code Recollection is both games merged into one continuous adventure. Same graphics, same presentation, same UI, and so on. I didn't beat Another Code Recollection technically, but instead the first part, which used to be its own separate game. Is any of this making sense? How they've reimagined these games is quite ambitious, especially for Nintendo remakes. So many Nintendo remakes stress faithfulness, almost to a fault. I don't want to say Recollection is like a Final Fantasy VII remake level of revisionism, but it is probably closer to something like RE2, 3, and 4, those remakes, in terms of the concept and how it completely changes up the gameplay. Like I mentioned last episode, I never played the series until now, so I have zero nostalgia for it. I'm going in completely fresh. And verdict? I enjoyed my time with it, but it does very much feel like, quote, my first adventure game. But I think that is the point. They want to introduce the genre to players who haven't experienced these types of games before. The premise is that you are a 14-year-old girl, Ashley Mizuki Robbins, who lands on an island one day looking for her father. You then team up with a ghost, yes, a ghost, and explore a seemingly abandoned mansion as you uncover the secrets of both your past and the past of the ghost named Dee. This is where the two memories come into play. The house is filled with puzzles, secrets, and an absurd amount of keys. You can think of it like Resident Evil, but without the zombies, which either sounds boring or sounds like a relief depending on what type of person you are. I am not a survival horror fan, so there is an appeal of doing all these weird puzzles in a cool-looking house without the threat of getting my throat ripped out. Each puzzle is pretty much completely unique, There are some with a similar execution, like merging items in your inventory, but most of the time, each puzzle is something you've never encountered before in the game. Placing dolls, overlaying photos, finding safe combinations, arranging blocks, you know, puzzles. None of these really blew my mind, and it can be a bit frustrating when you know how to solve it, but you aren't sure how the game wants you to go about it. Especially the photo overlay puzzle, where you need to put one on top of the other at a specific spot. Okay, which photo goes first? And then, I'm at the spot, but what do I need to click on? But outside of a few annoying ones, most of the puzzles are fairly breezy to figure out. I'd say there's about one puzzle per room, and I'm sure if I counted there would be, what, 20 or so puzzles in the game? Really not a whole lot, but since this is a Japanese adventure game, the text and the story are more important than the puzzles. The real meat of the game is the conversations between Dee and Ashley, plus reading all the diaries and notes scattered around the house. If you're text adverse, maybe this game isn't for you. I can see some people jumping directly into the game, hoping for a lot of the Nintendo-style puzzles, but they are spaced out quite a bit and take a backseat to the story. But if you are here for the story, the one told in two memories is interesting enough to keep your attention. There's some twists, some obvious ones, but still twists, and I think the game has a surprisingly strong conclusion. At first you might be thinking, okay, I'm reading about all these people, but they don't really seem connected to me, and I don't get their importance. But I think the game does a great job in wrapping up all the plot threads. Two Memories, in general, is a pretty fascinating title in terms of its place in Nintendo's history, which we talked about a lot last episode. On the surface, it's a pretty straightforward, text-heavy, point-and-click adventure-style game with a somewhat somber and melancholy mood, pretty atypical of the titles Nintendo normally puts out. But it was also a game Nintendo pushed as part of their Blue Ocean strategy to reach people who weren't typical gamers. This game was there to show people that games can be focused on story with some light interactive elements. When we think of casual Blue Ocean Nintendo titles, we jump to Wii Sports or Nintendogs, but Another Code is also a piece of that strategy. Playing it in 2024, without the context, you might think, okay, this is a pretty easy visual novel, but I think players would get more out of the game if they contextualized it. It does make me wonder why Nintendo decided to make this. They didn't just slap two ROMs on a cart. This is a from-the-ground-up remake, with a completely new perspective, new art style, and even the puzzles are wildly different. There are puzzles in the DS games that aren't in the Switch version, and vice versa. And you might think, well, because the DS has such a unique input method, they replaced puzzle A with puzzle B. But no, it goes well beyond that. When you do the puzzles, and what you do, are completely different between the two games. Imagine if in the Ocarina of Time remake, the layout, puzzles, and boss fight in the Deku Tree were completely new. I really wish Nintendo did a dev interview about the game. I badly want to know, why did you go through the effort in bringing the original team back together? I guess this is just supposed to be a mystery. And I'm still waiting for the Super Mario RPG remake interview as well, so Nintendo, you have a big backlog of interviews I want to read. I'm a little bit into the second game, Another Code R. Even early on, it does feel distinctly different from the original game. Ashley is older, and there are more NPCs, and the setting is completely different from the first game. The game is also supposedly much longer, around 10 to 15 hours compared to the 5 or 6 hours of Two Memories. The real meat of Recollection seems to be in this game, so I'll keep playing to see what Ashley gets up to, and just to see how different this game is from the first. It was built for Wii hardware, so I'm curious about how much more ambitious the game might be and what wacky motion puzzles await. Oh, I didn't mention it, but the actual Switch-related puzzles are fairly light. There's maybe two motion control puzzles in the entire game. I honestly would have preferred more wackier puzzles centered around the Joy-Cons and the HD rumble, the motion, the pointer, the IR camera, since those open up a lot of gameplay possibilities for a puzzle-focused title. Just look at all the crazy things you can do in WarioWare Move It. Right now, it is hard to definitively recommend Another Code Recollection. It's a full-price game, and there's plenty of competition out there. It's more fascinating as a piece of Nintendo history, and perhaps even Japanese gaming history, since it captures such a specific moment in gaming for the country, while also calling back to a lot of classic titles. I'll still keep trucking through Another Code R and hopefully give a final verdict in an upcoming episode. But Mario vs. Donkey Kong comes out soon, and rumors have it that the toys are back in town. That's it for games, now for the news. How about those sweet, sweet financial reports? Often they drop them right after I drop an episode, so by the time the next one comes out, it's old news, but thankfully, they timed it a bit better this time around. Nintendo released their 9 months earning release up to December 31st of last year, including the Q4 numbers for a lot of titles. Switch is at 139 million, getting closer than not to that magic 150 million number where the PS2 and DS rest. Many assume Switch wouldn't get near those numbers, but it very well could outpace both those platforms in a much more narrow window. It's hard to say if the Switch will cross the 150 million threshold, considering we don't know about the Switch 2's strategy. But at least 140 million is in the bag, something I'm sure Nintendo is very happy about. Worth noting that, in terms of the Japanese sales, Switch is at 33.3 million, meaning it is the highest selling console in Japanese history. It finally passed the DS, which sits at 32.9 million. Absolutely incredible. And on top of that, Switch also broke the software sales number in Japan with 232 million, passing 225 million from what? The Famicom. Yes, it took 40 years for the Famicom software record to be dethroned, but it happened. Needless to say, Switch is more than just a gaming console in Japan. It's a piece of pop culture history, a symbol of Reiwa-era culture. As someone who has been a Nintendo fan all my life, it is pretty incredible to live in Japan while this is happening. I've said it many times, but this is the golden age for Nintendo. Not sure if it's all downhill from here, but let's just enjoy the moment. Software numbers, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is at an absurd 60 million copies sold. Super Mario Party and Tears of the Kingdom both crossed 20 million. I've seen some discussion online about Tears slowing down quite a bit. It sold 18.5 million in its opening quarter, which was about 6 weeks, then under a million the next quarter, and under a million for Q4. I don't think this is anything to be too concerned about, or that there's some backlash against the game. It took Breath of the Wild nearly 4 years to reach 18.5 million sold, and after that, it had several sub-million quarters in a row. Tears not having a big Q4 boost is pretty surprising though, but it had more competition with casual titles, and the Switch now has a much larger library than it did when Breath of the Wild came out. But still, two-thirds of everyone who bought Breath of the Wild bought Tears of the Kingdom in the first 6 weeks, so it's undoubtedly a massive success. And Breath of the Wild is still selling. It moved 400,000 this past quarter. I do think there's a number of people who are like, I'll clear Breath of the Wild first, and then I'll pick up Tears of the Kingdom, which is driving these sales for the original game, but honestly, you can just jump into Tears. It's okay. But we have reached the point where if a Nintendo game doesn't immediately outsell the previous title, all is lost. Animal Crossing is at 44 million, and let's say the next Animal Crossing only sells 20 million. People will treat that like the apocalypse, without realizing that 20 million for any game is absurdly successful beyond comprehension. Oh, and Nintendo Switch Sports has now quietly sold 12 million copies. You don't have to like the sports baits, but you will respect them. Some newcomers, the biggest shock was that Super Mario RPG sold 3.14 million in about 6 weeks, making it one of the best-selling Mario RPG games ever. It's behind Bowser's Inside Story, which is around 4 million, and if you want to count Super Paper Mario and Origami King as RPGs, yes, it is slightly behind those as well. But I had to think this blew away expectations. How can you not do a Super Mario RPG 2 after this? Pick up the phone, Square. Pikmin 4 is also sitting at 3.33 pick-million copies, so it looks to have some pretty decent legs. The hope, the dream, is 5 million, which I think is very doable, especially if they put out some DLC. But it's the best-selling Pikmin ever, so we should be seeing more from the franchise sooner than later. But I wouldn't be surprised if you told me that Nintendo made more money from Pikmin merch at Nintendo Tokyo than they did for Pikmin 4. Mario Wonder is also at 11.96 million, which, again, great. It still hasn't passed New Super Mario Bros. U DX, which sits at a pretty 17 million. Both are excellent games you should buy. Mario games in general got a big bump thanks to the movie, and I expect 2024 and the Switch 2's launch will be very, very Mario-focused. Numbers are up, and I'm pretty sure everyone's happy. Though I'm not looking forward to everything basically going back to zero once the Switch 2 launches. Whatever Mario Kart 9 debuts at, people will freak out despite it having the most meaningless launch sales for any game ever. I do expect the Switch software to keep selling even while Switch 2 is out, especially if there is a focus on backwards compatibility. And hey, rumors say that a Nintendo Direct is a few days away. But I don't have super high expectations for the Direct. But I might as well toss out some predictions now. First of all, it is sort of going to be a swan song for the Switch. I fully expect the June Direct to focus on Switch 2 titles. I'm not expecting any huge game announcement to fill out the calendar until Switch 2 launches either. The only exceptions would be the heavily rumored remake of Fire Emblem 4 and that other 4 game, Metroid Prime 4. If Prime 4 is technically impressive at all, you might as well just save it for a cross-gen title for Switch 2. For Fire Emblem, Engage sits around 2 million, which is notably under 3 houses, but I don't think people are burned out on the series, and a remake of 4 would still sell 1 to 2 million copies as the baseline, considering the game is highly regarded and might get some nostalgia bias in Japan. Other titles, I do expect a few more ports and remasters. I think a Luigi's Mansion 1 remaster is absolutely coming, if not a shadow drop. I can see it being a $30 hoggy port, similar to Pikmin 1 Plus 2 and Sunshine. It doesn't make sense to have 2 and 3 on Switch, but not 1, so yeah, it's coming. I do think it will be the GameCube game and not the 3DS version. But I wouldn't be surprised to see another 3DS up-res. Kid Icarus is the dream, but I'm not sure they would just pull that out of nowhere, and I can see Sakurai wanting to get involved with it. Triple Deluxe and Robobot are just sitting there, waiting to be remastered, but honestly, I would prefer a remake akin to Return of the Dreamland Deluxe for Robobot, since that is my favorite Kirby game and deserves way more love than just an up-res port in the last month of the Switch's life. And another game that could be shadow dropped that I think a lot of people have forgotten about, Super Mario Galaxy 2. We are in the midst of Mario Mania, so a random Mario game dropped out of nowhere would make some sense. And of course, a smattering of indies and third-party games. Will Dragon Quest III HD reappear? Is the Final Fantasy Tactics remake real? Another Katamari remaster? We will know very, very soon. I do have one more episode before Pokemon Day, but let's just throw out some of those predictions now. A lot of people are suspecting something Unova-related, and that very well could be a big possibility. It would be strange to have a remake so soon after BDSP, since typically there are many years between the remakes, but like BDSP, maybe another company is handling the bulk of the development. We could see Legends Unova, which could be exciting, but I would rather the Legends team take their sweet, sweet time on their next project. I do think that we might finally see Pokemon Gens 1 to 3 on NSO. Maybe even in their own special Pokemon app. You could really just fill out the year with a drip feed of the old Pokemon games and then maybe a spinoff I may or may not care about. I don't think you need to break out a Legends or Gen 5 remake this year, especially if we are getting Gen 10 next year, but Game Freak and the Pokemon Company are not interested in slowing down at all. All right, let's wrap it up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so you can like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on February 25th. See you next time. Matane!